Just over 5 years since the COVID-19 pandemic reshaped our world, many of us are still grappling with its long-term impact. It was the most anticipated and planned-for disaster in modern history, yet it left deep and lasting scars. It's been said before that we're all disaster survivors now. From COVID-19 to devastating floods, the Grenfell Tower fire, the 7/7 bombings, and other man-made and natural catastrophes, the UK has faced repeated tests of resilience and its response. But how well have we really performed in the aftermath of these crises? What can we learn from the ways we responded and where we fell short? With us today is Professor Lucy Easthope, who is one of the UK's leading voices in emergency planning and disaster recovery. With over 2 decades of experience advising government, emergency services and local authorities, she brings a rare combination of academic insight and frontline experience. She's the author of When the Dust Settles, a powerful memoir that explores what it really means to live and work in the aftermath of disaster, and how the hardest part is sometimes returning to normality. Lucy, welcome to the We Society.
Thank you.
Before we get into the depths of this, just give us a taster of a disaster that was very vivid for you.
Well, I always say that every disaster that I respond to in some form always leaves its mark on my soul. But actually, the very first thought I had when the request to do the podcast today came in was actually the flooding across the UK in 2007. And I've seen many floods since, and the flooding internationally, because that's a real test of the society and whether you're going to respond individually or as a group and the sort of collective. And people always assume, I think, with disaster work that you see the best of humanity. Sometimes you don't. And so it's a really interesting memory for that, the 2007 floods. And so much of the learning has been forgotten. And that was where I saw the most remarkable community action. That stayed with me. Very different type of incident to some of the ones that I'm involved in. But particularly for me, I was based and living in Doncaster at the time. So it's the Doncaster floods of 2007 that are the ones that I will probably, you know, they'll be one of my last thoughts at my end, I think.
I mean, for those listeners who kind of went around kind of 18 years ago and kind of can't recollect those floods, just give us, walk us through.
So very rapid. It was June, so it was a very warm time of year, and there was a very surreal experience. Hot weather flooding is always a very strange thing. You have profound rainstorms, and then, you know, 2 days later, people are back applying their sun lotion. It was a very, very difficult summer. And it was a real test of the country's resilience, for which really we failed, as is quite a common UK theme. And that's charted in something called the Pitt Review. But some very iconic images of complete devastation of homes. The only thing we didn't really see with that is our big fear in flooding is something like a tidal inundation, where people would have, it would be even more rapid and even more damaging.
Your whole biography is one of actually being at the scene of, or being nearly at the scene of, some kind of crisis or disaster. Extraordinary. How is that? I mean, is that why you've been drawn to it?
So I was certainly a very intense young child. My mum had a very emergency birth with me, and I was quite an intense child. You become very animated about what was happening in the world, and then particularly in the aftermath of the Hillsborough disaster in 1989, when I was 10, I became a very passionate, early stages activist, for wanting to be there really to help and support people in the aftermath of emergency, which is quite a strange thing to take to your careers advisor. So I originally studied law, but with the intent of working in UK disaster management. And I'd assumed that would probably take some sort of policy or research or advocacy role. And then 9/11 happened, and I'd had a business card from a company that provided frontline response, and I applied the next day.
And you were involved in that, weren't you?
So the company that I worked for was sending out British team to Ground Zero, and I was coordinating the team members and some of the equipment from here. And of course, the other thing that happens if you work in UK disaster response and you're working in disasters involving British citizens, you have this situation where you've sort of got multiple tabs open on your laptop. So we're working on Ground Zero and an air disaster comes in Linate, and then the Bali bombings happen. And then we're also the contractor who provides the mortuary provision for the Iraq conflict. So there's a lot going on in your intray at that time. And what that did was, you know, as you said in your intro, I'm a passionate scholar of disaster sociology, but I'm also an equally passionate responder, which can make for some very late nights and a lot of extra reading. But I sort of try and always wear the two hats if I can. And the response work, it shouldn't be like this in one way, but it certainly validates you, I think, in the disaster community.
The disaster community. I'm intrigued. I mean, a lot of listeners will be intrigued. I mean, I don't think they'll have come across disaster sociology, disaster community, or even recognise that this is a focus for academic research. I mean, just give us a sense of what the academic research is and what the headings are under which you do research.
Oh, yes. And thank you for that. That was such a draw to the podcast, really, because it is a hidden world. And one of the things that brought me above the parapet and started me writing, really, was I'd done one opinion piece in the Guardian newspaper. And the reaction to that was so strong, of people saying, I didn't realise this was a world or a thing. And that's become quite a big part of my, certainly my social media activism, but my activism is for people to understand that this is a world, that there are plans and planners. And of course, that there is an academic basis. So disaster sociology is its own strand, but we also draw on things like human geography, medical science and technology sociology. And so our conferences can be quite eclectic. One of the things that frustrates me a little bit with disaster sociology is a lot of the conferences, and I understand why, but will be very devoted to definitions of terms. So what is a disaster or what is a crisis will be a big theme of a panel. And I rather cheekily sort of dispense with that at the start of When the Dust Settles, that I cheated by using the Latin and saying it's a collision of the bad stars and carried on, because it's, you know, I have a disaster bookshelf upstairs, and one shelf is just what is disaster definitions in disaster sociology, looking at temporality, phases, how many people affected, a little bit like, you know, does a tree scream in the forest kind of debate. One book I really recommend by a colleague is by the wonderful Sam Montano, who wrote Disasterology, based on her experiences in Katrina, where she consolidates incredibly effectively the disaster sociology in our field. So I was very grateful because that came out just before mine and did a lot of the work for me, really.
I mean, to arrive at the scene of a disaster and to articulate all of that must seem to some of the survivors, you know, both welcome and actually idiosyncratic. I mean, this woman academic is talking in these terms.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, there's a lot that happens in the early stages. So one of the early chapters in my new book, Come What May, is called The Impact Assessment. The chapter's called Taking Stock. And it's about all the different competing needs at an incident. And the responders are very well represented in terms of what they need from the incident, the forensic evidence, the gathering of witness testimonies, the securing of the scene. But my sort of specific niche is the care of the deceased, the care of the bereaved, and indeed, as you say, the care of the survivors, who often have very different needs to the bereaved. And then crucially, and this is probably my proudest work, is the care of, you know, our magpie hoard, as I say in my writing, our furniture of self, as Kai Erickson calls it, in relation to losses that occur in floods, all of the things that we had with us. And sometimes that's for the survivors as well. And it's an area where I'll be very vocal in something like an environmental evacuation. People have had to leave for flooding. But more urgently, I will advocate for the protection of the items from the mortuary and from the scene. And what I had pioneered with colleagues over the last two decades was how to do that and how to look after them and how to return them to families if that was what they wanted. And again, I think one of the things that disaster sociology struggles with is it's not particularly mainstream. And there's a very, very, very urgent short lifespan to be able to get these messages across. And so generally, my early experience was that the items would be lost, off into landfill, destroyed. They would overface police forces, really. So that marriage of being both a disaster sociologist and a responder meant that I would, you know, write in quiet times, I'd write the articles and I'd write the books. And then as soon as the incident occurred, I'd lobby for their protection.
The furniture of life, you call it.
It's Kai Erikson's term, the furniture of self. So Kai Erikson was a very eminent disaster sociologist.
I remember, just on a personal note, when nearly 10 years ago, my wife died, and I was kind of very struck how, in the instant, that furniture of self, you know, her effects all, you know, around the bed where she was in, you know, which had somehow, you know, meant something when she was alive, you know, was suddenly now kind of denuded of that meaning. I mean, the fact that she was even very ill. I often think about that moment, you know, that kind of moment from transition to life to death, and actually how all those inanimate objects, which they remain inanimate, but they required animation by that person being alive. And yet somehow some of them, you know, you do need one or two of them afterwards, actually, to remind you of that now dead self. See, and I imagine, and I'd had kind of months to prepare for that event. I mean, I knew it was going to happen. A lot of these disasters go to clear blue sky, don't they?
And I think that's where the personal effects take on a different meaning. And often I'll find myself sharing, you know, conference spaces, or I'll be reposted by a grief and bereavement charity. And what we find is that people do different things with personal effects. So things like pills on a nightstand, we'll often find that the family will just want rid of them. They're a reminder of a difficult time. Often families where somebody has died of illness or at home, they'll be interested in the items perhaps that tell the story of the young, youthful person. But with disaster, what happens is we see, for example, huge amounts of denial. It's an important part of grieving, but it's sort of fostered by the nature of the disaster. So people often will have very, very little chance to get a body back. They might get a body back, but they might not. But they will be able to see bank cards or a passport. So sometimes the personal effects take the part of a story. You watch people do all sorts of things with them. So they may not have been able to spend time with the body. So they'll you know, lay their hands on the item that you found. Sometimes they're a very difficult story. You know, they're letters, shopping lists. There's, you know, all kinds of things that are, you know, one of the things I write about a lot is the censoring of personal effects. And again, this is where you sort of find me, you know, one minute I'll be at a scene, and then the next minute I'll be at a conference doing science and technology studies, and we're looking at waste and Mary Douglas's ideas of dirt and waste. And because there's a lot of sanctioning and censoring in disaster management where people will say, oh, they won't want that back. Or they won't want to live there again, or that place is dirty, or that thing is contaminated. And so it's been very helpful to me to know how people react to concepts of damage and spoiled items, because that's what I tend to work with all of the time. And that was also something that, you know, in a slight tangent, became very relevant in the pandemic. We knew that people would find the idea of a disease or a virus quite distasteful. And one of the dangers was if you used fear to enhance contamination, the idea of the virus as contaminating, people would, you know, again, sort of be very wary of perhaps getting items back. So, in fact, one of the things that I've worked on in the last few years is the volume of personal effects that we now have in hospitals after the pandemic, because people were told not to take their loved ones' items home.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Well, what's disaster planning? I mean, it's obvious in a sense, I mean, planning for disaster, but what does it mean in detail?
I'm very fond of the plan. It can look very limited and minimal. It doesn't look like it's going to stand up to the test. They're often on pieces of paper, or more and more now you'll see them on a tablet. And I think one of the things we sometimes have with leaders or cabinet ministers is that the plan won't look enough for the situation. But I am, because I am in situations where I see people using it all the time, I am a fan of the checklist, the thing that takes you to the next place, and also the role of the plan as a psychological device to calm everybody down. So the value of something like a meeting agenda, regardless of the type of incident. I think people, you know, it's had been a huge window into the world having so much social media because people ask me questions all the time and people think we're very much more scenario dependent than we are as planners. The plan is designed to fit multiple types of emergency. So the first meeting agenda doesn't need the specifics. It just needs to help us organise. One of the things that science and technology studies had really helped me to understand was the fallibilities of the plan. It is an ordering device. It is a way of responders, particularly the blue light responders, police, fire and ambulance and Coast Guard, showing that they've got control, which of course, you know, is perhaps a human impossibility. But I particularly enjoy the planning process. A lot of my colleagues will say, you know, it's less about the plan and more about us all getting together in a room and talking through what we are going to do. I always say the only time I've seen a plan followed to the letter in my career, I've seen it come close to some things, certain stages of aviation incidents and things. People have been very rigid to the checklist. But the only time I actually saw a plan followed to the letter was the activation of London Bridge, the plan after the death of the Queen and for her travel and for the funeral and the queue and all of those kind of things. And I've analysed that sort of anecdotally. I think one of the reasons that plan was allowed to be followed was it was the one time we didn't see political interference. It was almost too big a plan for ministers to mess with. They sort of kept out of it. And then the second thing was that there was a sort of constitutional protection of it. So I've really made my peace with the fact that we perhaps will never see a plan fully adhered to unless there are those conditions. But, you know, I have to fight less than I did for the value of the plan. And I will get a call at least once a month for a newly established what we call recovery coordinating group, which is the meeting that comes after that first noisy siren stage. And we'll all be working to the same agenda. And that's a plan.
On the other hand, whether it's the response to Grenville, where, I mean, very damning on the inadequacy of the plan and actually lack of coordination, the same is true to an extent of a response to COVID. I mean, have we learnt anything?
I think one of the things with the rapid inquiry, and it's been very rapidly set up, and one of the things that gives me some comfort is that Baroness Hallett, who is the inquiry judge for the COVID inquiry, knows emergency planning very well. She'd done a very thorough report into the July the 7th, 2005 attacks. And she got to know, I'm making a presumption, but it felt like she really got to know what emergency planning was. And you can sort of see that carry across into the inquiry. And the other thing that's happening with the inquiry is that the modules report individually and in quite a timely fashion. So there is chances for us to do certain things. One big thing I think with the publicity around the book and me talking more is that people want I talk about in the books, the Skyfall effect. They want a Daniel Craig. They want a James Bond, screens on London, big control rooms. And then I've sort of bigged this up in both books, even the fact that I might turn up in a cardigan and check where the tea urn is at odds with the idea of what emergency response looks like. And that was very true of the start of the pandemic. There was a lot of kind of bluster and this plan isn't going to be enough. The other thing that was a major issue in both of those disasters that you mentioned is what was the Senate for 9/11 called the failure of imagination. We generally, with few exceptions, really struggle to imagine where something is going to go. So one of the hardest things in the very early stages of the pandemic was to convince civil servants and ministers that this was more than a few weeks. And if you know something is going to be years and years, you think through the consequences of your actions and your measures in a very different way. And there was no such thing as a 20-week epidemic. I got into a stage of calling it five bad winters, like a sort of old farmer. It was at least 5 years of initial trouble. We weren't sure what the vaccine would look like. And even if the virus itself was under control, the way that most countries' health services work is they work in a very time-critical way. So if you delay any operations or delay any diagnostics, you will see other types of health impact. So in a very anecdotal, almost qualitative way, although it's a number, we'd always talked about there being five deaths to every one virus death, either from consequences or from delayed illness.
We all remember it, but it doesn't seem to have a presence in day-to-day discourse, which at the time I thought it would do.
The areas of things like ethnography in sociology have been very good at was going out to places affected by disease. More recently, so there was an anthropology research platform established after the Ebola disaster of 2014. And so one of the things about having the academic life is you also indulge all of the reading and the review. So this wasn't a surprise to us at all. Disease epidemics are notoriously difficult to memorialize, to remember, to describe, to explain, to place into society. And what I've been very, very grateful for is because so many people knew that, there's been so many projects to look at that. And in fact, myself and three other scholars who were in international relations and biopolitics came together to try and archive, essentially, what was happening in 2020. And we, first of all, did a number of papers and presentations, and then that became a book. And it was interesting recently because somebody said to me, what research grant did you get to do that? And as you often talk about in your podcast, that's a big, big part of academic life, yeah. Getting a fellowship or a grant. And we didn't. We had no funding. We did it in our evenings. And it was from a place of such fear and such drive that we knew pandemics are incredibly hard to remember. What working in disaster had also taught me was that to move on very quickly and to move on very brutally is a very important part of political and economic recovery after disaster. So I've written for that book a piece on moving on and what a cruel phrase it is. And the world carries on. And that's a huge part of bereavement as well. You look out the morning after you've lost somebody and you can't understand why there's still sun coming up and birds. Why hasn't the world stopped? And I think when you see that writ large and not getting any easier either, and the pandemic, I think we are still processing what was asked of us, what we did, what we lost, what happened. And my instinct is it will be decades before other people younger than us will say, tell me about that time.
What's been learnt? There will be, my friends who work in immunology and vaccines and, disease control and spread all tell me that, the 21st century is going to be defined by these periodic epidemics. So when the next one strikes, what have we learned?
Often what we call in emergency planning the bricolage, the hidden work that changes for next time, gets lost and you don't see the good stuff. And so I've been very pleased recently to contribute to a project on disasters avoided, all the times that the good stuff learnt from the last time kicks in. And there's been some brilliant analysis, for example, of the recent earthquake and tsunami in Hawaii, and all the things that they learnt from before are put into place. But that's not where the news cameras go. The pandemic is a really difficult one because what we haven't been allowed to do is explore potentially what worked well. One big question that society hasn't answered yet, and it is a societal question, not just a political question, is that all previous pandemic planning up until 2020 did assume that government ministers would come out and discuss a level of triage. So there would be a limited amount of resources and this would be how they would be allocated. And that was essentially flipped in the COVID pandemic. And the idea was that society would be kept open to an extent. There would be very limited limitations, but there would be a higher death toll. And I think that's what's quite odd sometimes for people to get their head around, that as emergency planners, we planned for a much higher death toll than we saw. So one of the things we're exercising nationally in a month's time, and the death toll for the national exercise that we'll be doing is even higher. And I don't think we're having those conversations as a public. We're moving, I think, from a position where we look at the governments and the clinicians and say, you take care of me. And we're moving as a society to a position where we're saying, actually, you know, I understand there's limits on this. Tell me what I need to do. And the simple way that I measure this is when I started out on social media in 2020, if I posted about 10 tips to get yourself ready for a power outage, people would tear me apart, you know, and they would say things like, it's not our job to have to buy a torch. It's the government's job to take care of us. And I think one of the challenges that we have really struggled with the last 5 years is honest communication with the public. You know, every year we produce a national risk register, comes out, it's about the sixth item of the national news. There's not a single item on that that doesn't come with a toll, a death toll, damage to infrastructure, a number of survivors. But people are perhaps unaware of the challenges that are coming our way with so many things, but particularly I think the changing climate. You know, we're seeing much more rapid storms and flooding, for example, so we've got much less chance to save people. So these are the kind of conversations that I'm really interested that we start to have.
COVID-19, I mean, what was the hat you were wearing during the course of that? I mean, who was asking you questions from what department? And
yes, I was an independent advisor, which is how I always frame myself. And I was giving advice in on various policy decisions to the civil servants in the Department for Education, the Department for Health and Social Care, and the Prime Minister's Office. But I also took a decision which I hadn't done before, which was I did a lot more media and writing. And that was my coming out on social media at that point. So I became I'm always available to advise to things like charities, Ministry of Defence, but those were the government departments.
And social science and disaster management, disaster study. I'm interested how it informs what you've been doing the last 20 years.
Oh, it's everything. I can't imagine myself surviving, actually, without my academic study, because it gives me a contextualization. You know, I've just sort of, in the new writing, I've launched the disaster recovery graph in the world, which is the wonderful, it's about 100 years of disaster studies research into the graph after disaster, and particularly the slump that follows an initial incident. And I can't imagine not having had the privilege of studying that from the sort of scholars and mentors that went before me.
These are all the phases you go through, kind of slump,
yeah,
anger, depression, and finally getting out of it and moving towards reconstruction. But not, I notice,
yeah,
coming to terms with it, just reconstruction.
No. Reconstruction and survivance. So coming back with some courage and some humour and some defiance. And I just can't imagine whether I would, it's for other people to judge whether I'm sane, but I'm certainly happy and I certainly live life with delight and I'm certainly able to parent and love and laugh and live. And I don't know if I'd be able to do that without my disaster sociology, because that contextualizes. If I was just seeing it and I wasn't able to place it into context and I didn't know why a phase might be particularly hard and I think as I've got older, people are accepting, and this is a very positive point for the future, they're accepting that academic research into their policy and into their thought in a different way. And I'm very grateful. We've had a real kind of boon of very, very good scholars putting out commercial nonfiction, and of course on the television as well, and of course podcasts like this, you know, the growth and the love of podcasts. And all of a sudden it's kind of allowable to bring knowledge and research, evidence base, opinion, skills, and into what can be very almost thoughtless policy. And I mean that in a sort of deep sense of a policy without thought. And I think that bodes very well for the future.
You've also identified, and I just will finish on this note, I think, but I was struck by it. I mean, a kind of noun that's emerged, survivation. And you know, this is what, capturing a society or an individual's capacity to be a survivor from a disaster?
And to come back. To come back to something with, you know, and I use in Come What May the experience of the aftermath of Grenfell, where I've been partially healed and partially some sense making, because it is completely senseless, in this wonderful charity, the Latimer Community Art Therapy Charity, which helps children with their trauma. And that had epitomised something for me that I'd taken a photograph of many years ago in the Smithsonian, which was from Indigenous Americans, that said survivance is the way that you get through these things.
And survivance.
That place,
survivance.
And it's, you know, the place that I go to with the children is just full of noise and full of play. And there has to be something, doesn't there? There has to be something afterwards. There has to be a point and a purpose alongside the very necessary anger and the quest for justice. But also what I love about that definition is the deviance and the defiance. So, you know, I remember a big study was done after 9/11 that people weren't going to the official support centres. They were going to people's front rooms, or they were going to other places. And what I see actually most commonly in my work, which I think will surprise people, is wonderful defiance. You know, ministers will want the vigil at 3 o'clock, and the survivors and the bereaved will go somewhere else at 4. And I think that was that the importance of that was gifted to me as a child in Liverpool. The you know, it's coming back on your own terms. And that is something that puts me at constant odds with governments and advisors, but is incredibly important to me.
Professor Easthope, Lucy, thank you so much. It's obvious that you are a priestess of survivance, apart from being a kind of very expert sociologist and applying it to a realm that I think many people will have really not occurred to them, that it is a realm that should be in receipt of that kind of analysis and coming up with the kind of recommendations and thoughts that you do. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a privilege to have you on the We Society podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.